Hello there, listeners. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware from the Council on Foreign Relations on the history of far-right political terrorism and some of the policies that can be implemented to address this problem. At a certain point, Jacob had asked me, from a social work perspective, what recommendations I could offer to combat political extremism. Now, looking back, I wasn't satisfied with my response because my response wasn't based on my social work background, but on my background as an independent academic conspiracy theory researcher, whose understanding of conspiracy theories is based on the scholars that I've had on this program. But as always, I've decided to do some research on this topic from a social work perspective, and I'm glad to inform you that I came across a literature review that addresses the very question Jacob had asked me. So as we celebrate social workers in the month of March, I hope you find today's discussion informative and a wake-up call for any social worker interested in addressing political polarization. So with that being said, let's dive in. Hello, listeners. Welcome to this edition of the Social Chemist Podcast. I am your host, Nelson. And on today's episode, we are joined by Royce Hudson, a social worker associate professor in Boise State University. Royce's area of interest focuses on disaster survey methodology and need assessment, as well as countering and preventing political extremism. On today's episode, we'll be discussing his 2021 paper titled Preventing Violent Extremism and Social Work, Recent U.S. History and Prospects, a literature review that looks at the history of prevention extremist programs post 9/11 and the role social workers have in addressing radicalization. Royce, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Royce, it is a pleasure to have you on the program as a graduate student in the School of Social Work at Rutgers. This area of political extremism tends to be pretty lonely for me. Most graduate students in the School of Social Work focus on LGBTQ rights, systemic racism, environmental justice, and violence against women. When it comes to extremism and conspiracy theories and misinformation, the topics that I look into, as mentioned before, not a lot of people that I can interact with. And because of that feeling, there's been times where I've wondered if the MSW has been the appropriate program for me. Perhaps the pathway of political science and public policy would have been more appropriate for the stuff that I cover on this podcast. And being that political extremism is a macro level problem, and since social workers, generally speaking, work at the micro level, I'm curious to know how you found yourself studying this topic.
Well, I was always kind of a macro social oriented person. Now, when I was in my master's degree at University of Georgia, I had actually was interested in direct practice social work, but got interested in macro practice during that time, mostly because I saw that a lot of the direct practice skills was really just addressing and providing sort of a quick solution, if you will, to much larger systemic problems. And that for me, if I was going to make a huge impact in this area of interest at the time, it was substance use disorders and the treatment of SUDs, that I need to really think much more broadly, especially around issues around poverty and exclusion. From that, with the help of a lot of really good professors, I ultimately went to Wisconsin and got my doctorate there, looking at, studying poverty policy in particular. And that got me into that macro realm. So my orientation changed during my education from a micro focus of practice focus into a macro focus. And I credit my professors for that. From there, I was fortunate to get a faculty position where they hired me initially to be a pretty much a poverty policy analyst, which I would have expected given my dissertation was on that. But really early on, I moved into first disaster and armed conflict studies, which was a natural bridge to extremism studies. I had been in Haiti, or I was working in Haiti with a graduate student, and we were assessing the impact of the 2004 coup that deposed Jean-Bertrand Aristide and what the impact was on the civilians in Port-au-Prince. And from that study, we identified that gangs and other criminals were really responsible for a lot of the devastation that Port-au-Prince experienced in that during that time frame, and unfortunately is currently going on right now. And as a result of that study, we got a lot of play and in the media, and I was invited to do some work in Lebanon, looking at the Israel-Hezbollah war, and that got me into extremism, right? So Hezbollah, the foreign terrorist organization everybody I imagine is familiar with, and looking how that war impacted people in South Lebanon and their attitudes towards Hezbollah in South Lebanon and their attitudes towards gun and gun violence broadly. That study led me down a career path where I'm currently at now, because from that work, I got additional work in studying why people in the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon were, especially young adults and youth, were adopting a transnational jihadist ideologies that was not typical of a typical Palestinian refugee at the time, and what that in what sort of the antecedents were to why these young adults and youth were adopting these ideologies. We wrote several papers on that, and I've been working, and then ever since then I've been working on some of that. I got called in to study the impact on Haiti earthquake back in 2010, so that took me away from that research. And then ultimately, fast forward to now, I've gotten back into moving away back from humanitarian research back into preventing and countering violent extremism. So the path was a little circuitous. However, I think social work was a good fit for that. I mean, I think a lot of what we found in that research and in subsequent research by others really suggests that social work has to be a critical player in preventing and countering violent extremism. If you read the literature from various different groups throughout even internationally and here domestically, you'll see the word social work or social workers all the time. Whether it's through behavioral threat assessment and management, a lot of talk about social workers. When you're talking about primary prevention, looking at how do you prevent kids from going down the rabbit hole initially, whether on the internet or through other direct recruitment techniques, they talk about social workers. If it's somebody who's already radicalized and you're talking about disengagement, there's talk about social workers. What can social workers do? How do they engage? What should they be doing with these folks, etc. Social work is a constant theme, no matter what level of intervention down prevention. So I don't think that your initial take about is this a great fit for me, given that there's not a lot of social workers involved, is misplaced. I think for me, I mean, I would agree with you, there's not a lot of social workers, and there's not even a lot of social work academics in this. I can name the number of social work academics working on this in one hand, and I know all of them by on a first name basis. Though that is not a good, I mean, first of all, man, credit to my colleagues that I work with, but it's not sufficient for the field, I feel, in given the threat and to not just the individual victims and their families, the communities that are victims of terrorist violence, and then what that means for our democracy and democracies in other countries as well. It's important that social work gets involved in this. We have long history and experience in violence prevention, community violence, gang violence prevention. Social work's been involved for decades. Domestic violence, all the various types of violence against women, teen dating violence, bullying, you name it, social work's been there, and they've done a pretty good job. I mean, sometimes it's not been as effective as we might like, but for the most part, we've found various pathways to preventing a lot of types of violence. And, you know, I in my mind, you know, this is just a kind of another type of violence. Yes, it's, but I think, you know, yes, it has different wrinkles than these other forms, but we should be at the table along with our political science colleagues and other disciplines.
I want to talk about what the current programs or interventions for preventing political extremism look like. Now, from my understanding, during the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s, the focus when it came to political extremism was emphasized on the white nationalism, the National Alliance, Unit 88, the Christian Identity Movement. And then we enter the 21st century, and then we have 9/11. And then the focus changes from domestic terrorism to terrorism abroad in the Middle East. From 9/11 to now, how has prevention and political extremism changed or evolved?
Well, it certainly has evolved quite a bit. If you think about it, and this was outlined in my paper that you referenced earlier. You know, initially, you know, there was a sort of law enforcement military approach to it. We were just going to arrest our way or kill our way through this, right? So arrest, capture, kill. You know, so it was whether it, that's abroad, in the case of Al-Qaeda and later ISIS, and their affiliated groups, or here domestically, as it related to, you know, targeting initially Muslim majority country or counties and municipalities. Which really resulted in quite a bit of a backlash, and a deserved backlash, I might add, from those communities and other advocate social justice and civil rights and human rights activists around the fact that, you know, we're basically saying that Muslim communities were dangerous. Muslim communities are not dangerous. Yes, those the attack was Islamist inspired, but it wasn't really generated necessarily out of the United States. And you know, and asking people from these communities that have already marginalized in many regards to racism and xenophobia to now report on their fellow compatriots in their communities is a really troublesome sort of paradigm when it comes to primary prevention or even secondary prevention. It was it many advocates and many there's still advocates that believe this, that the FBI and other Homeland Security officials that are targeting and their agencies that are targeting these communities really were violating their First Amendment rights and other sorts of rights. And you know, and a level of monitoring was oppressive. More currently, and this is came out in the 2019 Homeland Security framework and has been expanded since, said, look, you know, the Islamist jihadist threat is not the number one threat in the United States right now. It's racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism. You know, we have plenty of statistics to back that going quite back from, you know, the 2019, going back even pre-Trump administration, where we've seen a rise in RemV-related violence. That's the term we use in government, RemV, for racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism. And that the real main, and it's like I said, even today, this the main threat is RemV. And from that, you know, now we also talk about anti-authority, anti, or sorry, anti-government, anti-authority violent extremism, well, so militia-related violence. Those types of violence are much more common than Islamist-inspired terrorism or from foreign terrorist organizations. Acting against the United States. So that framework changed. When the focus changed, the approach changed. And I'm not sure what sort of how that sort of played out. Like, why did we also change? I mean, I understand why we changed focus. What I didn't understand is actually changed approaches. So we don't really think about targeting, say, rural white, predominantly white, lower income towns for these kinds of prevention efforts like we did, say, in Dearborn, Michigan, for post 9/11 secondary prevention efforts, that is, finding people who are radicalizing and trying to intervene. Now, the ideas around REMV prevention are more like, you know what, we're going to set up these consortiums in these communities. We're going to have a systematic plan where professionals, social workers, teachers, counselors, anyone that has sort of touch with the public, we'll create a reporting mechanism. We'll send out professionals, including law enforcement and social workers and counselors and psychologists, et cetera, and we'll assess them to see if they're truly, going down this path of radicalization and what level of threat they present, excuse me. And then we'll move from there about what we should be doing, and we'll refer them to counseling and all this other stuff. That is a way different sort of project when it came to domestic terrorism than what we saw. Now, that's not to say that behavioral threat assessment is new. That came out after like Columbine and the school shootings. We adopted that strategy towards lone wolf terrorist acts and organized terroristic violence, like through Proud Boys or other groups. And I think that's one of the biggest changes we're seeing. And we're not seeing the sort of covert racism that you saw when we're talking about Islamist-inspired terrorism.
When it comes to the social work interventions, I'm curious to know what that looks like when we're dealing with political extremism. A while back, I had Carol B. Cox, who's a social worker from Fordham University and focuses on conspiracy theories. And when I read her paper, she had mentioned some of the things that social workers can do to combat conspiratorial ideologies. But when I asked her, like, to be specific in that, he couldn't give me a proper answer. And the reason why was because when it comes to at least people that believe in conspiracy theories, these are individuals that don't want help for the most part. Their convictions of their belief are very strong. They don't believe that they're wrong. I feel like the same thing is true when it comes to someone that's an extremist, someone that believes that, for example, that the election was stolen. Doesn't really want to see a social worker, and that's not the first thing that comes to mind. And so, if social workers are going to develop interventions in addressing, political extremism, what does that look like? Because we know we, as you said, we need it, but then it's trying to put into the details that I often feel that social workers kind of like, we don't know what to do. Maybe I'm wrong in this assessment.
You're 100% right, and that's the million-dollar question. I'm certainly working on it. Others are as well, about what this is supposed to look like and how it works. Britain's been doing this for 15 years now through their channel program, at least the secondary part of it, which is identify people that are going down that rabbit hole, get them some kind of services, see if we can prevent that ongoing radicalization process. If they're already completely radicalized, still same story. Let's get them some help if we can. Obviously, if they're planning or that sort of level of threat and risk, then you're bringing in law enforcement and others. But on the social work side, if we can get them before that, what should we be doing with them? The literature that has been written, it mostly comes out of the UK and Western European scholars. The takeaway for me of that literature is that we don't know much, and they generally treat it as you would any other social problem that your client might experience, especially when it relates to youth and young adults. Some folks recently have really started making the case, and I kind of agree with this, that there is a lot of parallels between, especially when you talk about youth and young adults, with a lot of other social problems that youth and young adults experience, whether it's substance use d disorder related problems, whether it's suicidality, whether it's issues with just rather self-esteem and other developmental challenges. Those problems are very similar in trajectories than what we see in the radicalization process. Whatever model you look at, there's dozens of different types of radicalization models out there. But they all sort of share some of the same commonalities that you would find as a process for, say, a youth or young adult beginning to start of experimenting with drugs and alcohol. So some of that thing is interventions, especially early on, are believed potentially to be also able to prevent the ongoing radicalization of somebody. I think there's a bit of a wrinkle here because of the identity issues that are, and the sense of agency issues that are attendant to the radicalization process. It's pretty clear now from what research we have on predictors of radicalization to violence that identity and sense of purpose are two major factors, push factors and pull factors for people to radicalize to violence. So we need to directly address that sense of agency, see, internal, external locus of control, however you want to frame it, and its relation to radicalization to violence, especially for those who are joining these groups and looking for a sense of purpose on top of a sense of acceptance and belonging. And then in two, when you look at especially young adults who are committing a lot of these terrorist acts, if you look back in their histories, they're typically pretty troubled histories. And social work is very good, I feel, at working with folks with troubled histories. We ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, is something that's a common lexicon in social work, and it relates to lots of different social problems in adulthood. We know how to intervene on some of that stuff effectively. But with that being said, we don't have a set protocol in place for what to do if somebody's espousing or are beginning to espouse a violent extremist ideologies. The other thing, and this is what's led me to my particular focus on primary prevention as opposed to secondary prevention, which is even if we do identify folks that are espousing these ideologies, if they're adults, they don't have to engage. Like they could say, no, thank you. And even if you look at the most recent Maine case where that person went and shot up all those folks and killed so many people, known to law enforcement, known to the social service and medical providers in the community, the person had been on I think a 48-hour hold earlier. Police had went to his house to try to confiscate his guns, and that person was still able to go out and do that stuff. And that I think is really sort of a something we need to really carefully think about when we're focusing strictly on the secondary prevention and not thinking about the primary prevention, which is how do we prevent kids from going down that path in the first place, and young adults. What are those key things that they can learn or do? And I think there's some things we already do that are helping in that regard. I think things like increasing social emotional intelligence in kids, school-based programming and anti-bullying programming and teen dating and violence prevention programming have what we call PVE adjacent impacts. That is, preventing violent extremism impacts outside of their direct impact. What I'm arguing is that we probably need a direct program that's focused on sort of the factors that are associated with extremism, social motives, social media and media literacy, critical thinking skills, and then working on senses of identity, healthy senses of identity and agency. That I think really is sort of the key thing that social workers can be doing, and we've been doing for quite some time. Now we just have to kind of reconfigure it to focus specifically on preventing violent extremism. Now, what does that look like? I'm working on that. Like we have sort of frameworks. I work at the State Department, so I'm very familiar with the international frameworks that have been developed by our colleagues in other countries and through multilateral organizations. And the frameworks that they're proposing are things that social work has already adopted. They talk a lot about whole of society approaches, and that's even been in the domestic context, which is you need everybody. You need social workers, educators, business owners, pharmacies, medical providers, everybody across the gamut of sectoral representation needs to come together for a plan of action, and everybody be involved in these plans of action. And they have to be localized plans of action. They can't be coming from capital cities, or they can't be coming to Idaho. They can't be coming from Washington, D.C. They have to come from the localities in which these young adults and kids belong to. Because the way that, at least anecdotally, the way we professional practitioners think about this is that the push-pull factors that are tended to violent extremist pathways are geographically localized. I mean, they're localized geographically. Even if the recruitment's online, push-pull factors that are geographically specific. So this is common public health practice. When you do a substance use prevention program, all of those programs are locally designed. So I've been arguing is we should be doing locally designed prevention programs, a very similarly to what we'd be doing with substance use prevention or cardiovascular or whatever. All of these plans are really localized, and they should be. And so at least my current research project is doing just that, which is, can this work in this context? We'll find out. It's early, and I don't have any evidence to share right now. But right now, we're just looking to see if we can even form these consortiums, given the political environment. But once we can, can we develop these logic models? Can we develop, no, can we implement them? Does it have impact? My thinking is, given that these kind of localized plans have worked in various other public health arenas, it should work if we do it with fidelity. But again, we don't know. And it's the same thing with BTAMs, these behavioral threat assessment and management plans, like I referenced earlier. We don't have any evidence that stuff works, really. And evidence, like, oh, we helped this person or that person, the other thing. But in terms of changing the base rate of the number of attacks are going up. The number of hate crimes are going up. The number of incidences are going up. So, and BTAM has been growing the whole time. The number of these initiatives in the country, and it's a real focus of Homeland Security and other related agencies, Department of Justice, et cetera. And I think, I think that's, I mean, I think one, we should do that. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. I think we shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket, though. We really do need to focus on primary prevention. The secondary prevention stuff, we still need to figure that out. I think folks are thinking already that, there's lots of trainings on this across the country, and people are reading these trainings and going through them thinking that this is all evidence-based. And I'm here to say, I don't think it is. And I mean, maybe I have a higher standard of what constitutes evidence-based, but what we're doing now is spending millions and millions of dollars on something we're not sure works. At least I'm not sure as a professional social work professor thinks works. And given our colleagues in the UK and their experience with a similar program, and the fact that they haven't been able to demonstrate efficacy in the past 15 years, suggests to me that what impact it does have, if it does have an impact, is minimal in the global scheme of things. It's not right now, we can point to various people that we might have intervened with successfully, and that's great. That's important. And I'm glad we did that because anyone that gets, thinking about Maine, when you miss folks, the impact can be devastating. And so we have to be really hard-headed on this and think very carefully about what it is we're doing and where we're putting our eggs. And right now, I'm not sure we're prioritizing in a way that's the most efficacious use of those eggs.
You talked a little bit about the elements that contribute to radicalization. Now, there is a discussion of whether psychopathologization should be considered in the discussion of how people become extremists. And this is controversial because people argue that if you prioritize or focus on psychopathologization, you ignore the psychosocial factors that contribute to radicalization, which include the accessibility to firearms, unregulated social media, mainstream media that tends to be hyper-partisan at times, the policies that were enacted during the COVID-19 lockdowns that contributed to loneliness and not feeling secure, some would argue. But at the same time, when I spoke to Jacob Ware, he had told me that perhaps we should look into it because sometimes there has been evidence of individuals that commit crime with disorders like anxiety disorder or autism spectrum disorders. From your perspective, how do we have this con how do we address both mental disorder and the social elements that contribute to radicalization without ignoring one or the other?
Yeah, that's a great question and something I grapple with all the time. First of all, when you look at sort of the broad spectrum of who commits terrorist acts, the types of terrorism matter. The folks that act on their own as lone actor terrorist folks, those folks typically have higher rates of mental health conditions and higher levels of adverse childhood experiences than you would find in the general pops. And then also too, though, when you looked at more organized extremism, let's say joining a militia, a violent militia, or that sort of thing, those folks have a tendency to have not much psychopathology relative to the general population. So it's important to sort of disaggregate what is what there. Now, when we're talking about self-inspired or those lone wolf attackers, they represent such a small, vanishingly small proportion of people with mental health conditions that we can't, we run the risk of just saying, well, people on the spectrum or people with this condition or that condition are more likely to be a terrorist. That's very troubling. We found that there's a good study out of Virginia from a couple of years back that showed, because they've had a school-based sort of threat assessment program going on in Virginia schools for some time now, found that for the most part, there wasn't really any sort of racist or gender-based problems. But what there really was that kids with disabilities, especially those kids on the spectrum disorder continuum, were more likely to be flagged. And we certainly don't want neurodiverse kids from being flagged as potential threats. So that's problematic. Now, with that being said, trauma writ large is very much associated with violent extremism. And again, people, victims of trauma also are vanishingly small number of those engage in terrorism. I would argue that if we had a robust mental health care system, that ch chances are we would never get to that place in which we have these lone wolf attackers because they feel isolated, depressed, lonely, etc., disengaged, excluded on a variety of different indices, social, political, geographic, cultural, etc. That if they just had like access and destigmatization of mental health care, we'd probably see lower rates of these things. And that's the way I think we should think about it is we need to improve the system broadly if we want to really think about this in terms of mental health. Mental health, social workers do not make good law enforcement officials. I mean, nor should they, and vice versa. So to ask, the social service network writ large, not just social work, but our sister disciplines, to say that, hey, we all should be able to catch these folks before they get to this path and somehow some effective intervention to prevent them from going further down this path and becoming to endanger themselves or others, that's a big ask, man, because I don't see how that works given the current level of funding and expertise that this country has to be able to carry that out. And that's why going back to that sort of primary prevention thing I was talking about earlier, which is because we can't catch everybody at that, and even if we can, we don't have a surefire way to quote unquote cure them. That's not how mental health works, right? I mean, I'm sure by now you're familiar with that. That, and all of a sudden this is going to be the answer to domestic terrorism is more social work. I don't think so. It has to be a much more nuanced, there's no silver bullet. And certainly we don't want to label people with mental health conditions as being dangerous. They're way more likely to be victims than be victimizers. And so from there, that's not to say, hey, we see someone, they're espousing some racist, violent racist stuff. We should talk to them. We should provide them with services. We should be monitoring them if we can, etc. That's important to do. But that's not the solution. That's just, and we can have a systematic way where we try to capture as many people as possible. But even if that's all we're doing, we're going to miss a lot of folks. Just think about the realm of untreated people with mental health conditions in the United States, and you get a pretty good idea that aren't violent. You get a pretty good idea how many people we are missing that are violent. And then, it has to be, we have to work at primary, secondary, tertiary. We got to have the whole spectrum if we're going to effectively tackle this. And we can talk about, the coarseness of the political dialogue. And, I mean, there's not even dog whistles anymore in the political discourse. It's straight up bullhorn. And that has real impacts as well. So it's not just, well, everybody's mentally drained and it's creating more violence. There's a lot of things happening in the macro sphere that doesn't have anything to do with social work, really, like communications, right? I've never worked this much ever with communications professors until the last 5 years of my life. I'm glad I am. But a lot of what we're talking about is, just the macro sphere and what's ex considered acceptable dialogue nowadays that is really extraordinarily troubling and violent. And then it provides that avenue for people to say this is an acceptable behavior, which is one of those push factors, because now they're thinking, if I do this, I'm going to go and gain notoriety. I'm going to be important. I'm going to exert a sense of agency through being able to exert violence on others for a particular cause.
I want to go back to the classrooms. Now, as I mentioned before, the social work schools don't really touch on this. How do you think the School of Social Work can implement the education on political extreme interventions, and like what courses or just the framework and how they teach this stuff? What are some suggestions, if you can give any?
All right, so at the risk of self-aggrandizement, going back to that paper again, I've mentioned this. We don't, if you look at the Council on Social Work Education's accrediting standards and you type in the word prevention, I think you'll see it like twice, right? There's no real standard or expectation that any schools of social work are going to have a course in prevention. I mean, prevention of anything, right? That's astounding to me. And going back to what I said earlier, prevention science broadly should have an impact on preventing violent extremism, just like it does on any other social condition we were just talking about. And then the fact that the schools of social work aren't required to at least address prevention. Now, that's not to say schools of social work don't have classes in prevention, but we don't require it, really. And I think we should. I mean, social work is such a sort of reactionary discipline, right? Something bad happens, we intervene, and hopefully things get better. We talk about the macro world and improving sort of, the global environment as it relates to racism, discrimination, xenophobia, etc. And that certainly has impacts, no doubt about it. But we can also engage in primary prevention work that ameliorates a lot of those social conditions like discrimination or racism that can have impacts on people's perceptions that will improve ultimately those conditions by which people would engage in violent extremism. So working in rural communities or ex-urban communities where a lot of the problems reside here, and working with them and providing, some of these programming around self-efficacy and building identity and that sort of stuff, and health, just general healthy trajectories, adolescent trajectories, we can do that. And it doesn't have to be called, Royce's PVE program. It can just be, healthy development program or whatever you can call it. And it would just be, I mean, it would have PVE focus, but we'd never call it PVE. We'd say it's just about growing up and being successful. And that would have this, in my mind, an impact. I mean, it wouldn't be obviously a silver bullet, but again, it would be one of those things in our quiver that we can utilize along with secondary prevention and along with our partners in law enforcement on the tertiary and incarceration side of things. And when we have that spectrum, then I think we can really make a dent in the number of incidences of terroristic violence. I mean, excluding foreign terrorist organizations is a different thing. But on the domestic side, I think we can do that, but we have to have all of those pillars in place. It can't just be focused on arresting people after the fact or trying to change people's minds. Once people are radicalized, mind you, we're in a totally different world here where primary prevention isn't going to work. Secondary prevention is too late for that. Now it's just whether how we mitigate that risk. Good thing is most people even espouse those ideologies don't actually go out and commit crimes. And identifying those who have the violent extremist ideologies versus those who commit violent extremist acts is a total different line of study that's difficult to disaggregate. So what do we do once they're doing that? We don't have a really good idea. Right now, the operating theory, at least in my office, is disengagement. How do we get them to do other things like getting a job, getting reconnected with their family, just sort of living the day-to-day life? And the more they do that, the more repetition they have with quote-unquote normal, the less likely they'll be perseverating on that radicalized ideology to the point that it's eventually give up on that ideology as they become more and more comfortable with the day-to-day rhythm of life. Now, I work on foreign terrorist fighters coming back from Syria to their home countries. Some folks have been advocating for re-education stuff, especially around religion, because I work a lot with the ISIS moms and kids. And in that case, that's a little bit different. But I think it has domestic applicability here as well, which is, now re-education really has not demonstrated much efficacy, but many countries that we work with really do think it does. So there might be a grain of truth in there somewhere. If you look at the case studies of folks, a lot of them sort of self-de-radicalized. They became disillusioned with the organization or with the movement for a variety of reasons, and then seek a pathway out. One of the things we do also advocate for is providing those pathways out. So when somebody wants to get out, they have an opportunity, like call this number if you want to leave this particular violent group, and we'll help you do that. And we do that with lots of different other social problems, right, with domestic violence and other avenues. And we provide that same sort of avenue for those who are radicalized. But again, how effective it is not really well understood, in my opinion, but we should do it. And also, too, prison DRAD is something that we haven't really thought about carefully enough either, as prison violent extremist organizations, white supremacist gangs in particular, I'm thinking about. And once those folks are released, there's not a lot of reentry programming around those folks, and they're going back to their communities and doing all kinds of nefarious stuff. So we need, they have a lot of criminal elements outside of their violent extremist ideologies, right? Drug trafficking, etc. But they still have these really racist and violent ideologies, and they're criminal, and they got money because they're engaging in a criminal enterprise. So they can present another real threat. And we really haven't talked as a sort of community of practitioners about what to do with those folks. I mean, there is some programming and such, but there's not a lot of lid on it. So there's so much, I guess I say this to say this, which is there's all gaps everywhere in the literature where social work has an equity that we don't know what works or doesn't work very well. And we have some ideas, we have theory, we're kind of building the plane while we're flying it. But we really do need more. I mean, as a professor, this is going to sound self-serving, but we really do need more research. It's not just a professor saying we need more research. Like, I think any observer from the outside that wasn't in my position would say the same thing.
Final question, and I want to take things to a domestic level. When I had Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware, I asked them, what their thoughts were on the state of extremism in America, being that, and this is sort of kind of a political question by nature, but I'm curious to know how you see the U.S. dealing with this social problem, being that there are elements of the far right that are terroristic or just they engage in terrorism, and the ever-growing election denialism movement that's growing within the Republican Party as a whole, as a nation. Are you optimistic that we can overcome this as a social problem, or are you concerned with the state of the country and how things are progressing with the 2024 election coming up?
Well, I'm certainly concerned. Also, I'm a social worker, and therefore I'm inherently optimistic. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in this position. So with that, I'm super concerned. And I think you point out some very important aspects of the political discourse that is happening and the amount of disinformation that is out there. When we have politicians talking about, polluting the blood of, like you're just talking about really well-established racist tropes that have led to violence historically, whether it's against African Americans or Jewish folks or what have you, that level of rhetoric, it immediately precedes levels of violence that we don't want to experience, we don't have to. And, I think the mainstream media calling those folks out is a good thing, but the problem is the people that need to hear that are in information bubbles. That they're not receiving that messaging. And I've listened to a couple of your podcasts where other folks have mentioned this as well, that the echo chambers that folks exist in that are hearing that violent rhetoric over and over and over again has really, in my mind, the potential for all kinds of psychological problems that relate to fear and anxiety. And where, next thing you have people shooting up a pizzeria thinking they're, disrupting a pedophilia gang run by Hillary Clinton. And you wonder how they got to that place. And it starts with that mainstreaming of a lot of that rhetoric. Like, they're coming over the border and raping our women. And, like, that's just dehumanizing all sorts of folks. And of course, there's a lot written about dehumanization as a precursor to violence. That stuff is extraordinarily scary, no doubt about it. And it gives agency to those, or it gives permission, if you will, to those folks who feel like they don't have, anything to lose, and they don't feel like they have, and they're being told that their election is being stolen from them, and they don't have any political agency, and it's being taken over by the Jewish left on the coasts, et cetera. And if you have no, there are, we're losing our country, quote unspeak, quote unquote. And then unless you do something that's extra legal, we're going to turn into some sort of dystopian left-wing hellscape. It's not surprising to me that certain folks will take that up as a call to arms and start shooting people up. And we've talked about gun availability. It's not hard for them to get firearms. Then they go up and, they shoot up a predominantly black grocery store in Buffalo, because they want to, stop the, whatever the left wing tilt of America somehow.
We have our work ahead of us, Royce, but I want to thank you for your time. The conversation was informative. It was eye-opening. I know a lot of social workers are going to be listening to this episode and to our discussion, thinking about, how we can tackle this problem and, the roles that we have. So I appreciate your work and your contribution to this field of study, because we need individuals like yourself and others that are going to help people like myself understand the gravity of this problem. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for having me again.
Hi there. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Royce Hudson and found our discussion on social workers' role in combating political extremism informative. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to subscribe and leave me a 5-star review. By doing so, you help expose this podcast to people who might be interested in conspiracy theories and extremism when in politics. If you're listening on any other platform, be sure to subscribe to get more analysis on the conspiratorial mindset. You can follow me on Instagram and on Thread at The Social Chemist. You can find me on Substack for my newsletter. Royce Hudson's literature review on political extremism can be found in the show notes below. If you're interested in similar discussions with experts, be sure to check the recommended episodes provided in today's episode description. So with that being said, take care, be safe, and question everything with logic. Thank you.